Senator Herman Talmadge, Democrat of Georgia, now retired, living near Jonesboro, Georgia, interviewed on Friday, November the 8th, 1990.
I just thought maybe we could talk about a few things. You're a survivor, you know, a sort of a revolution that's gone on in the South since 1945 or so, and
I survived till 80 and then I got beat.
Yeah, but I mean, you're still hale and hearty, and yes. You're enjoying your life. You got some good bird dogs out there,
right.
I see. And
I think I got my mother's gene. She lived to be 101.
Your mother did? Is that right? That's amazing. I wonder if, when you think back on all that's happened in the South and all that, since the end of the war, really, I mean, that's when the huge change. Heidi.
It's my wife, Linda, Mr. Edgerton.
How you doing, Miss Talmadge?
I'm fine. Excuse my cold.
All right. Oh, it's turning chilly out there.
Aubrey's already fixed him a cup of coffee, honey.
Good. Sure did.
Well, good.
Yeah, she took good care.
You didn't have to wait too long.
No, ma'am.
Good.
I hadn't been here very long at all.
Okay.
Thank you.
So much has happened. It's really, you know, you go back and you start reading newspapers and magazines and you just think, gosh, either I didn't know all this happened or I'd forgotten. It was just so much.
Passes gradually and you don't notice it like you would if it just suddenly jumped out of it.
Right.
My house, being blindfolded. It's been phenomenal, really.
Let me ask you a little bit about earlier on. You came out of the service, didn't you, in about 45?
Yes.
Could you give me just a little bit of the background, your military background?
Sure. I was commissioned in Naval Intelligence as an ensign in April 1941. I was called to active duty in the intelligence office in Atlanta in September 1941. I'd been trained for cable sensors work in New York, and shortly after the Japs hit Pearl Harbor on December the 7th, I was transferred to my mobilization assignment, which was 67 Broad Street, New York, where we were centering telegrams and cablegrams.
How old were you at that time?
I was born in 13, so I was 27 years old.
27 years old. Out of college a few years.
That's right.
Out of law school.
Practicing law. Uh-huh. I started practicing law in Atlanta. And then I got fed up with cable sensors work in New York, and I requested combat duty. And they sent me to the first ship midshipman school at Northwestern University about the middle of 42. And in that same class was Robert Taft, Jr. And after I finished midshipman school, they tried to teach us the fundamentals that you learn in the Naval Academy in 4 years and 60 or 90 days,
uh-huh.
I've forgotten. And then they assigned me to a ship that was under construction in California, USS Tron. It was a disguised hospital ship. The Japanese paid no attention to the Geneva Convention. So while it was a hospital ship, we were heavily armed for an auxiliary and could fight or pretended to, as auxiliaries did. They
uh-huh.
really weren't equipped for much battle,
uh-huh.
but they did have guns and things of that nature. I served as a division officer in her and then was transferred from that to New Zealand, where I became aide to Commodore Jupp and flag secretary down there, and afterwards transportation officer in New Zealand. And then after I'd been in the South Pacific for 22 and a half months, they sent me home for 20 days leave, as I recall, and a pre-commissioning detail at Rhode Island, New York. And afterwards I was made prospecting executive officer of an attack transport, APA 97, and when the ship... Go ahead.
Sir?
Sure.
How about you, sir?
No, thank you. I appreciate it, Bob.
Well, excuse me for interrupting.
Thank you.
You're very welcome.
When the ship was commissioned, we acted as auxiliary training ship afloat for the Atlantic Fleet at Newport, Rhode Island for about 60 days. We'd take details out for a week and run them through the routine that similar auxiliaries, attack transports, experience, and let them stand watches alongside our men. And I went to the South Pacific then, and we engaged in the campaign for the Philippines, and I participated in landing the 1st Cavalry Division in Tokyo Bay while MacArthur was dictating the surrender ceremonies. Then, after the war was over, I had far more points than I needed to be demobilized, so I came back and was placed on inactive duty. And about November 45.
In November 45, so that's when you
got there. So I served a total of 52 months. Went in as an ensign and came out as a lieutenant commander.
So you were back back in Georgia then at the beginning of 46 and back in law practice and interested in politics.
Just shortly before my father engaged in his last campaign for governor in 46.
Right. And do I have it right that up until about 1940, governors served 2-year terms and could succeed themselves, and that got changed?
Elizondo was the first 4 years.
Was the first 4-year governor, and he could not succeed himself.
That's correct.
So then the 46 campaign, which turned into that kind of musical chairs, the two governor thing.
My father died, and the legislature elected me, and went through the courts. I won 2 out of 3 court decisions on the lower court. Lost the state Supreme Court decision 5-2. Then I vacated the office, announced I'd carry it to the people, and won for the unexpired term of my daddy in 1948.
Which means a 2-year term, again, in effect, that election was for 2 years.
Unexpired term of Eugene Talmadge, that is what I served.
And that did not disqualify you to run for a 4-year term.
Yes.
So in 1950, you ran
elected for a full 4-year term.
For a full 4-year term. And then were you elected to the Senate in 54?
I had a 2-year hiatus. I was elected to the Senate in 56.
Okay. In the 50 campaign, when you won the full term, as well as 48, some of the reading that I've done indicates to me that Governor Arnold might well have challenged you. Could he have legally challenged you in 48 for that, or would he have been considered ineligible to run?
He would have been ineligible in 48. He would have been eligible in 50.
But he didn't make any go for it, did he?
No, he did not. We had the acting governor, or rather the M.E. Thompson was sitting as acting governor. And the Arnold Group and the Rivers Group supported Thompson.
Did it surprise you some that Arnold never really made a serious run again for governor?
No, it would have been impossible for Arnold to challenge Thompson because he was acting as governor and he was a member of the Arnold faction. So it would have divided their forces irreparably.
I see.
Now, if Thompson had stood aside and let Arnold on, it would have been different.
I see. Knowing what you know now about all that has happened since the 1954 Brown decision and all the civil rights stuff and everything, you think you would have, if you had it to do over, you'd do anything any different than you did while you were governor? I'm not thinking about the senator.
I'm sure there would have been some particular things I would have done different. What are you referring to?
Well, I'm thinking, for example, about the white primary.
No, I wouldn't have been elected if I'd done different.
Wouldn't have had a chance.
Not a snowball chance in hell.
Yeah. Some people would have said the same thing about Arnold with respect to the poll tax. but he went ahead and took
it
on.
No, that was not the issue that the white permanent.
Didn't have the emotional impact.
In fact, my father supported repealing the 45th.
Did he?
Yes. In fact, the overwhelming majority of the people were probably in favor of repealing the poll tax.
Uh-huh.
But at that time, only probably 10-15% of the white people were in favor of repealing the Democratic white primary.
Mm-hmm. So you had a solid 85% white mandate.
Not that many votes,
no,
because
but,
people don't vote
right.
directly on issues, but sentiment of the people
yeah.
was about
yeah.
85%.
That's pretty hard for a politician to ignore, isn't
it?
If he wants to stay in bed.
Well, if you want to challenge it, just don't run for public office.
Yeah.
Resort to the court.
During that time, a great many whites, and you yourself, used to say, the problems that we have in this region, we can work out. And if the federal government will not interfere in this, we will work them out. How long do you think it might have taken for us to have
actually,
come to
by the time we passed the Civil Rights Bill, any black that wanted to vote in Georgia was registered and did vote. As a matter of fact, during my father's race in 1946, probably 130,000 blacks voted in that primary. By the time I ran in 48, probably 200,000 blacks voted. We didn't pass the Civil Rights Act until the 60s.
Right.
By that time, virtually any black that wanted to vote in Georgia was voting.
Mm-hmm.
Now, breaking down segregation would have taken a little longer.
Yeah.
They were beginning to make some inroads in the cities,
mm-hmm.
but not in rural areas. It probably would have taken another 25 years on the segregation.
Yeah. Would it have been a good route to go, do you think? I mean, you felt it pretty strongly then.
It would have prevented lots of turmoil and everything else that we did have. Of course, the route that we should have gone, when they passed the 14th Amendment, that really was the basis of all these so-called rights, and still is. And at that time, we ought not to have ever had segregated schools or segregation in the South. Once you adopt a pattern and a mode of conduct, with all of the laws involved, including your Constitution, it's been in being for over 100 years.
Mm-hmm.
People don't change their habits.
Right. Really don't.
Yeah.
And I've done some reading too back on in that period of time, and the laws really came into place between about 1877 and the turn of the century.
Right. As a matter of fact, we didn't have the white primary law in Georgia, I don't think, until about 1917.
Yeah, after the turn of the century.
The Neal Primary Act.
Right. And so then
they had done it, though, by resolution of
uh-huh.
the Democratic Party prior to that.
Uh-huh.
But blacks voted in the elections up until, I guess, the early 20th century.
Uh-huh. And then you had 30 or 40
what,
years where
right.
I mean, it was just...
Well, what made the people so mad and disgusted them so? See, the blacks had, unfortunately, a lower level of education than the whites. And they would vote, say, 10,000 votes in Augusta, Georgia. The results would be 9,995.
Mm-hmm.
It's just like voting cattle a pine tree.
Yeah.
And that's the reason they disfranchised the blacks.
Yeah. Well,
Daley in his heyday couldn't muster the votes that they did in those days.
Yeah.
It was like voting. Manipulated,
yeah.
bought and sold just
yeah.
like cattle.
Yeah.
And that probably had more to do with disfranchising them than their color, really.
Uh-huh. Prior to the Brown decision, that was in 54, those cases were in the lower courts for about 3 years. And even before that, there were some higher education rulings
that ruling in Texas.
Yeah.
On the university system out there that antedated the voting.
And some of those went back quite some time, and looking back on that now, it seems to me that people surely must have seen this coming. And yet when I talk to people, regardless of their point of view on whether they think Brown was good or bad, they still say they were shocked when Brown came down.
I tried to anticipate it to some degree with my university, with my building authority. When I took the governor's office in 48, there was inequality in teachers' salaries between whites and blacks. I equalized them. There was woeful inequality in the schools between whites and
blacks. The buildings and all of that.
I had a mammoth school building authority. We built more schools in Georgia than any state in the Union except New York and California. Each one of those states had about three times our population and a much higher per capita income. I did that to try to equalize the opportunity for blacks and whites. When I took office, the white children were riding school buses to school and the black children were walking. I changed all that. So I equalized the salaries, I put them in school buses, and I put them in good buildings. Frankly, part of that was to try to stave off the threat of integrated schools. It didn't work.
But could it have worked?
Looking back on it in hindsight, it could not have worked, probably with the lawsuits. Looking back on it in hindsight, it was a proper thing to do regardless of motive. And it should have, when they passed the 14th Amendment, following the war between the states, they ought have broken down the barrier of segregation
right then,
that time.
Yeah.
And then we'd have never had the problem that we had in the courts and on the local level and everything else.
Right. But when it got to, it was your responsibility, and it fell on you to deal with the whole notion of the law said separate but equal, the courts
and
were
the
about,
people said
and
that
the people
too.
Said that, and the courts were about to say something else.
And I was between the people and the court,
yeah.
Really.
From an economic standpoint, leaving aside the politics and the all that, from an economic standpoint, do you think Georgia could have supported two separate school systems that would have ever been adequate in the larger scheme of things?
Well, we did in those days, and strangely enough, more money was spent on education the worse the SAT scores get.
Yeah.
So there's a hell of a lot more to schools than just money. I found that out when I was governor.
Yeah.
It takes an app teacher and an apt pupil to have a good school, and you can do it under the shade of a pine tree if you've got that.
Yeah.
But the main problem with education today is the fact that we've had a complete breakdown in discipline in this country. It's true in the homes, it's true in the schools. They don't use the rod anymore. They used that freely when I was a student, and I needed every whipping I ever got too. And they all helped me. We've had a complete breakdown of discipline in your homes and your schools and your workplace and even in the military.
Yeah.
That's the problem with education today.
Well, there's no doubt that a whole lot has changed in this society, and and right now I think everybody's got an uneasy feeling that nobody knows quite how to get it back on the track.
Discipline, and I don't know quite how to do it.
But prior to Brown, were you shocked by that ruling? Did you go along thinking that it would never happen?
I knew what the decisions of the court had ruled. The latest one, as I recall, I believe it was 1896, and I think it was Fulbright's decision. And I knew that it was not unheard of to reverse decisions. But I thought in a matter of that fundamental, the courts would be pretty slow about it. And the real shock that I got was Warren got a new unanimous decision.
9-0.
Yeah.
And Plessy, the
Plessy
1896 had been set, and it was 7-1.
Yeah, that's right.
It was 7-1. Charles Evans Hughes, I think, was the only dissenter. Mm-hmm. So that was virtually unanimous.
Yeah.
This was a complete turnaround. And yet,
it was a judicial revolution and a political revolution, really.
And yet from the time of, by the time Roosevelt had put...
Herman Talbot. Yes.
It's all right. We were talking about that that period of time right in the early 50s when the cases were in court and whatnot. And Brown was unanimous, and that was really the shock for a lot of people, I think.
I wouldn't have been so surprised if it had been a 5-4 decision,
right.
But unanimous for
sure. Right. Let me ask you about Ralph McGill.
Yes.
He was he opposed you pretty much through the time you were governor.
I'm not sure he exposed some of my philosophy. I'm not sure Ralph McGill didn't vote for me. Our personal relationship
yeah.
was good, and he had many kind things to say about me personally in his editorials. We violently disagreed on the segregation issue.
Yeah, but up until Brown,
he was a strong segregationist.
Yes, he was. His view.
In fact, everybody was, but about 10%, as I told you.
Yeah.
Ralph was the personification of liberalism in Georgia, and he was a segregationist also.
And it wasn't.
Old Tennessee hillbilly.
That's right.
Makes it natural.
And when he changed his mind on that was when Brown came down.
Yes.
And his view, which I think historically you'd have to say was the correct view, was, I don't care whether I like this or not, this is now what our constituted system says.
He was just way ahead of public opinion on
yeah.
that issue.
And from that time on, he caught a lot of flack.
He did.
Because he stuck
to it. In fact, he was hated for 2 or 3 years by yeah. most of the white people.
What was your view of him in that crucial time right after 54?
My view of what?
Of him.
Well, our personal relationship was cordial. My first campaign against him, he talked to me. We had a debate. We didn't have television at that time, and he was a moderator.
Uh-huh.
And he handled it extremely well, fat on all sides, and he said many very kind things about me in his editorial columns. The only thing we basically differed on, as I recall, was white primary and segregation.
Mm-hmm. And as you look back on it now, would you concede that he was historically right in
well, perspective hindsight, yeah.
Yeah.
He antedated public opinion about 8 or 10 years.
Yeah. Do you have admiration for him for taking that position?
Oh, sure. I attended his funeral.
Pretty lonely position there for a while,
yeah.
wasn't it?
Yeah.
Because as you say, I mean, he was bucking 80% or more of the white
opinion. He was a very courageous man. And a very fine writer. Strangely enough, now my father's relationship with Ralph McGill was very cordial.
Was it?
They got along fine.
Yeah. What about Ellis Arnold? Did you have a good personal relationship with him?
After I got in the Senate, Ellis and I developed into a good, close friendship. And when I ran for re-election to the Senate in 1962, the first contribution I got, $500 from Ellis Arnold.
Is that right? He was identified as a liberal in the 40s.
He was ahead of his time.
Do you think he was... Was he a segregationist liberal the same way as Ralph McGill was?
Well, I'll tell you what he said in his opening campaign speech against my daddy in 1942. The race issue was involved there. And he was opening his campaign down in Noonan. He said the white people in Cayuga County know what to do if a black tries to go to school in Cayuga County, so he was threatening them with lynching.
Yeah.
That was his views in 42. Well, then he got to be governor, and I think got political ambitions nationally. Roosevelt, you know, had a way of picking out some 8 or 10 governors and
yeah.
leading them to believe they were going to be on the ticket
yeah.
to for vice president. And I think Ellis got the political bug at that time and sort of got more in tune with the national agenda than
yeah.
public opinion in the state.
But you don't interpret that as being reflective of his personal views?
Well, I don't know. I wouldn't want to say exactly what his personal views were. But as long as he's in Georgia politics, I know what his personal views were.
They were essentially segregationists.
Yeah, when he got national politics, well, maybe he had a change of heart.
Yeah. Here's a question I've wondered about a lot. When 48 came, you were running for governor. Strom Thurmond and Fielding Wright bolted the Democratic Party, went off on their own, and you never blinked an eye. I never saw anything in the record to indicate you even thought about going with them.
I know.
Why not?
I know it was a futile effort. Third parties had no chance, and I had already been nominated for governor on the Democratic ticket, and I knew I had 4 years ahead of me to govern this state, and I didn't want to make a blinding run for something like that. So I stayed away from it. Strom Thurmond was a cousin of mine. My brother was a cousin.
Is that right? Yeah. Well, did you lend any visible or even token support to Franklin Roosevelt in that election? Harry Truman in that election?
Stayed out of it completely.
Stayed out of it.
Georgia went overwhelmingly for the Democratic ticket. Had I gotten involved, possibly I could have carried the state for Strom Thurmond, but I didn't attempt to do so.
And over next door in Alabama,
they went to Thurmond, South Carolina went to Thurmond, Mississippi, Louisiana, and Arkansas.
In Alabama, even though Jim Folsom was the governor and was pretty far more toward the left.
He was
and,
real liberal. Yeah.
Yeah, and yet they couldn't even get the Democratic Party on the ballot in Alabama. How do you read all that? I mean, that was a real salad bowl of mixed up stuff that year, wasn't it? But your conviction was that you could steer a course independent of the National Democratic Party and the Dixiecrats.
Well, I didn't steer any course. I just was a Democratic nominee and making plans to take office, and I didn't participate in the general presidential election at all.
I see. Would you characterize your views at that time as being identical or similar to those?
Well, they were sympathetic with Thurmond.
Thurmond and
Wright. But I knew it was a useless chase. I believe they call it Don Coyote chasing windmills.
Yeah.
I didn't want to get involved in
that. During your first term, let's see. From the time you were elected, you really went into the governor's office to be governor, really, in 48. I mean, that was when you were elected.
Yes, immediately after the general election in 48. I took office in November 48.
What was the reason for that, rather than in the spring of 49?
Serving the unexpired term of my daddy.
Uh-huh.
See, I wasn't elected for a regular term.
I see. Right.
M.E. Thompson was acting governor only. The Constitution provided he would serve until the next general election.
I see.
And when I was elected, I took office.
Yeah.
Now, the rest of the ticket didn't take office until the next January.
Yeah. And the whole white primary thing was the big issue of that period then, wasn't it? And your feeling was, as you said, that you really felt you had no choice. That
I wanted to be in the political arena in the state.
Yeah.
And that was my views at that time.
Uh-huh.
My views politically and my views personally.
Yeah, right. Do you think of that now?
Anyone that has studied carefully the Reconstruction history of Georgia would have similar views,
mm-hmm.
without the present experience.
Yeah. Well, as you think back on it now, do you have any regrets about that? Do you wish you had maybe had seen it a different way?
No, sir. If I had, I'd been a private citizen and never served as governor or senator.
Or senator.
Yes, sir.
During that time, a couple of people whose names show up in the newspaper clippings I wanted to ask you about. One was a professor at the University of Georgia named James Barfield, something like that. And in 48, he was a sort of a liberal guy, and he announced for office on the Henry Wallace ticket and got fired at the university. Do you remember anything about him? And a guy named, a Baptist preacher named Joseph Rabin.
Yeah.
And he also ran for political office. Yes. What do you remember about him? I'd never heard of him before until I ran across
him. Joe Rabin was pastor of my daddy's church at McRae, Georgia.
At McRae?
Yes, sir. My home county and my father's hometown. And when my father was running governor, he got involved in the campaign, speaking out against my daddy. And naturally, my father's a preacher and small town in South Georgia.
That's okay.
And he told me the press played it up as though it was the second coming of Christ.
Uh-huh.
Do we have a public radio television schedule? Yeah.
Rabin was constantly in the press as a great man. Nobody ever heard of him prior
to
that
time. I'd never heard of him until
being pastor of Gene Talmadge's church and opposing Gene Talmadge made him a hero immediately in the eyes of some. So he didn't last very long at the church. He was unchurched, and as I recall, maybe ran against me in 48, as I remember. I tried to, I don't remember who.
No, but he ran for something. I think maybe he ran for the Senate.
Anyway.
Can't remember now.
Anyway, I got him a job when he was unchurched in Atlanta. I forgot what it is.
You got him a job in the state government?
No. Some private industry job. I've forgotten the details.
Yes. Why'd you do that?
Because they were hungry. I've lost contact with him completely.
I understand he died. I asked somebody about it.
He never did preach anymore. And I forgot the job I got for him.
Uh-huh.
It was something in the private arena.
Yeah. Some of your other contemporaries while you were governor were Folsom in Alabama. What'd you think of him?
Folsom was an attractive fella, sort of like you. Don't like to compare a man with a dog, but that's the best analogy. If you've got some dog that you're particularly fond of, you know all of his weaknesses and you don't want any bastard picking on him. That's the way I felt about Jim Folsom.
He had a lot of weaknesses.
He had lots of limitations, but he was an attractive fella.
Yeah.
I didn't want anybody picking on him, just like I wouldn't want you to go out there and whip him puppy. That's the way I felt about Jim.
On this whole issue of politics and ideology, was he a real liberal, do you think? Was he an integrationist?
Well, I think he was. He supported Henry Wallace and all that sort of business over in Alabama.
What about Sid McMath over in Arkansas?
Sid was a liberal. He was a Truman fellow. I don't know what his views were on integration.
What about Earl Long?
I knew Earl well. Earl was a liberal governor. I don't know what his views were on integration.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think about all these people in this particular period of time because again, in you know, hindsight is always so crystal clear. Looking at this period now, from 45 to 50, it strikes me as a kind of a golden opportunity for the South to kind of fix its own social wagon on its own terms. And it kept on saying right on into the 50s and 60s, if y'all will leave us alone, we can work this out. And now when I look at that period 45 to 50, and there was this sort of new spirit of possibility as a result of victory in the war and the economy changing and people having been out into the world and come back, whites and blacks alike, and with a few people to just say, why don't we fix it now? Why don't we just go ahead and make some changes, allow some political rights, try to really fund the schools to where they're equal. Maybe not attack the whole segregation issue head on.
Segregation issue, starting with my building authority, equalizing teachers' salaries, put them in school buses, all practical purposes. When I left office in 1955, the school system was equal in Georgia for whites and blacks.
But anyway, this is just kind of a theory of mine, I guess. You don't see that period of time as a missed opportunity, do you?
Well, first governor was elected. As late as Jimmy Carter, he was elected on George Wallace's coattails.
Yeah.
Of course, he changed his philosophy with his inaugural address and wound up as president. But Georgia wasn't ready for overt integration at that time.
All right, so we're talking from 48 to... We're talking nearly 25 years, aren't we?
Yes.
20 to 25 years.
Even after Carter, people of Georgia elected Lester Maddox governor in 1966.
That's right, that was after Carter.
About 1970, when George Busby came along, it was about the first time race was not an issue in this state.
That's nearly 25 years.
Gubernatorial election.
Yeah.
And so that's 53 to 70, a period of...
That's 17 years, but we're really talking about from after the war.
About 20 years, yeah. And even George Busby wouldn't have dared mention the integration at that time.
Yeah. So what you're really saying is, it happened as quick as it could have happened.
Just about that.
Yeah.
You don't change mores and attitudes of people by law. It takes time, education.
Yeah. In light of that, would you, again, looking back on the Brown decision of the Supreme Court, would you see that as a tragic mistake, or was it our salvation?
Well, I don't see it as either. I see it as evolution of legal principles, and of course the state slowly evolved and the region to accept it.
Was that a good direction for us to have moved historically?
Well, really, we should have started long before.
Yeah.
We should have started with the 14th Amendment.
Yeah.
It could have been done with ease then.
We
just lost the war and they'd crammed it down our throat. Point of a bayonet. That'd been the time to do it.
Yeah. We kind of muddle along one way or another. Are we moving in the right direction?
As what respect are you talking about?
Is this region? Did the South, has it ended up being the South you wanted it to be, or is it falling short of that?
Well, the whole country's falling short of what I want it to be. South, economically, I think it's making more rapid advance in any section of the country.
And maybe other ways too.
That's right, other ways too. But there's many shortcomings in our society today. Of course, you can't change them. If I was a dictator like the power of Adolf Hitler, I'd probably do a lot of things.
Yeah.
But when we see the work ethic destroyed, when we see morality destroyed in this country, when we see the discipline destroyed, when we see fiscal sanity destroyed,
mm-hmm.
it makes you wonder whether we're not in the last days of the Roman Empire.
Yeah. We've certainly got some...
Many parallels.
Pretty, yeah. It's
many
kind of chilling, isn't it, when you think about it. But I'll get back finally to the first question the first thing I said, you're kind of a survivor. This revolution has taken place right through your lifetime. You've lived through it. You're hale and hearty and able to look at it, look back on it, and see all these changes that came to this region. And leaving aside the greater problems that we have, are you satisfied with what has become of the South, the South that we once had is certainly not here, but is the one that we do have.
You're talking about racial customs.
Yeah.
Alone, yes. I just gave you my views of the whole nation.
Yeah.
And that includes the South. Mm-hmm. We've gone downhill dreadfully in many respects in the last two decades.
Yeah.
I don't know whether we can correct it or not.
But on this racial thing, you feel like we've probably come out pretty well on this?
Yeah. All of the dire predictions that many of us made didn't come to pass.
Yeah. Which maybe says something about the character of Southern people, white and black.
Actually, I'll tell you a story now about the relationship between blacks and whites. My roommate on my first ship at this guy's hospital ship was Mac Perry. He was also from Georgia. He was a newspaper man. He went to Mercer University. We had aboard our ship at that time what we called the S Division, which was the blacks.
The S Division?
Yes.
Wonder what that stood for.
Cook, servants, really.
Uh-huh.
They were cooks and the chefs and cleaned up the ship and cleaned up the officers' quarters and all like that. Every time one of those fellas, they all had Yankee division officers. They were supposed to go to the division officer when they had a problem. They didn't do it. Black from New York would come to either Perry or myself if he had a problem. He wouldn't go to his officer who was from New York or New Jersey or something like that. I have remarked on that to many people who served in the military in World War II. They told me the same damn thing was true in the Army and all other branches of the service. Somehow the blacks trusted a white Southerner to try to help them. They figured that the white Northerner would give them lip service only, which was true. Perry and I would try to help them. These other officers wouldn't. So there's always been a relationship there of trust between whites, blacks, and whites in the South. That's not true and wasn't true in other areas of the country, and I don't think it's true today. And that's one reason Jimmy Carter was nominated by the Democratic Party, 1900 and whenever it was, when he was elected president. Even though they figured he was a Southern redneck, they figured they could trust him. Of course, he wasn't portraying redneck views in those days. I don't know what that relationship is, but it's been historically true in this country.
And in your view, still is.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Certainly there are differences that are remarkable when you just get out on the street. You know, just in casual contact, relationships in the South are different than they are in other parts of the country. Senator, I've really enjoyed this.
Enjoyed seeing you. What do you do?
I write.
Only write,
yes,
nothing
sir.
Else?
That's all I do. And
when I was in college at the University of Georgia, Time magazine would come out Thursday afternoon, and it cost 15 cents. And I would take my 15 cents and go up to the store and buy me a Time magazine and read it from cover to cover.
This had been in the late 30s.
Yeah, early 30s. Mm-hmm. I finished law school in 36. And I thought any man at that time that read Time magazine from cover to cover was reasonably well versed on current events domestically and internationally. And then I got out of school and started reading Time magazine, a lot of things where I knew the facts. Lenin came in to see me when I was governor and wanted to know what I thought of Time magazine. I let him have it with both barrels. I told him the same story I've just told you.
Mm-hmm.
I says, now, when I see a Time magazine story about the South, I know that it's only a satire. It's written to be cute and to entertain. It doesn't have a damn remote reality about South.
Mm-hmm.
I says, the greatest economic story that's going on in America today is the industrialization of the South, and Time magazine hadn't had one damn word to say about it. About 3 weeks later, the Time cover was industrialization of the South.
Well,
when I found out that that was true, Time tries to be cute.
Yeah.
And I read it thereafter right. For entertainment only, not the facts.
Right. One more quick thing, and I know your wife needs to ask you.
Yeah.
So, I was just going to say, I'm glad you could come down.
Thank you so much.
He's a writer. He's published about 18 books. Mm-hmm. This is going to come out in about 2 years.
Right. Were you,
he's going to talk about the transition of race relations in the South.
You were at the University of Georgia in 1932 then.
Yeah, 31 to 36.
Do you remember the night that Franklin Roosevelt was elected?
Yeah.
Where were you that night? What anecdote can you recall about that night, election returns or anything?
I don't remember the details. Of course, it was foregone conclusion at that time that Roosevelt would sweep the country.
Were you active in politics yourself then as a student?
Only for my daddy. He was governor at the time I was a student there. And I started working in his campaigns in 32. Then I was a freshman.
He was elected, election
year. He was elected 32. And my job was to advertise his speeches. One of my jobs. That was in the days when politicians went from courthouse to courthouse and faced the people and talked to them straight
right.
instead of reading 20-second slogans over an idiot board.
Right.
And the way we would advertise speeches, we'd take placards and nail them up on trees and country stores and courthouses and put little circulars in automobiles and hand them mm-hmm. out on the streets. And I walked in Cedartown, Georgia one day. I was passing them out in these stores, you know. The meat markets in those days had sawdust on the floor,
right.
Big old chopping block about 4 feet in diameter, and the fellow would stand there with a meat cleaver and cut up the meat. I walked in and had this fellow circular. He was about 6'3" and looked like he weighed about 240. Looked at me, I wouldn't vote for that goddamn son of a bitch for nothing. He said. So that was my introduction to politics. He was too big for me to hit,
I guess so.
Didn't want to run. And I didn't want him to call my daddy a son of a bitch, but I knew there was nothing I could do about it.
So
I walked out with my tail between my legs, and that was my introduction to politics.
Wow. Did you see your dad's campaign as being tied in any way to the Roosevelt thing?
Oh, everybody in the South. In the election that you referred to.
The 32 election.
Election you're referring to, Georgia cast 90-some-odd percent of its votes for Roosevelt.
Wow.
Your Republicans in those days were blacks, and what we call post office Republicans.
Yeah.
That was some fella that hoped he was going to be appointed postmaster
right.
or rural letter carrier, and that was the reason he was a Republican.
Yeah.
And the evolution of the Republican Party in Georgia started with Roosevelt's re-election. And the Republicans have been gaining strength every election thereafter is the philosophy of the candidate.
But in 32, it was pretty much a solid thing.
I don't imagine you could found a white man in Georgia that had admitted publicly in 32
right.
that he was against Roosevelt.
I talked to Governor Coleman over in Mississippi not long ago, and he told me a very similar story. Yeah. He was a freshman at the University of Mississippi that fall, and he told about listening to the election returns on the radio and how excited he was, and he thinks of that as when he
Coleman was elected governor, he came over here to study what we'd done in the school related to Mississippi.
Yeah.
Talking about the race relations, I was a senior at the University of Georgia when the University of Georgia was integrated with Pamela.
Is that right?
And Charlene.
And Charlene Hunter, who's now on the nightly news.
Well, I was a senior,
yeah.
And when the governor started talking about going to close down the University of Georgia, I thought, this is ridiculous. Most people thought it was that there was no reason to have such a hullabaloo about two people wanting to come to school.
Yeah.
I went to work with the Extension Service, and there had been blacks Extension Service out of Whiteman, and I was in the middle of that integration.
Uh-huh.
And that proved to be real interesting.
Yeah, it
went smoothly where I happened to be.
So much has happened, you know, it's really, really remarkable when you think about what changes we've gone through that we never dreamed we would.
Yeah.
And it's just fascinating. Well, I've really enjoyed seeing you all. Thanks
good to
again.
See you.
Nice
okay.
to meet you. Good luck on
thank
your
you.
Project.
I certainly appreciate it. I'm going to need it. Bye.